Tonight on PBS News Weekend, on the brink of another government shutdown, we get the latest from Capitol Hill. Then after record-breaking heat this summer, why certain areas of cities like Austin, Texas, are hotter than others.
We need to be thinking about what we need today, but also what are strategies we need to be doing in the next year, 2 years, as climate change gets worse.
And what to know about screening, diagnosis, and treatment of prostate cancer. Good evening, I'm John Yang. On Capitol Hill, lawmakers are taking 11th-hour efforts to avoid a government shutdown at midnight tonight, right down to the wire. This afternoon, the House overwhelmingly passed a 45-day temporary spending bill after House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, unable to overcome disagreements in his own party, turned to House Democrats for help. In the end, more Democrats voted for the bill than Republicans. The measure includes the $16 billion in disaster relief money that President Biden wants, but not the aid for Ukraine that many House Republicans don't want. But that's only half of what's needed to avoid a shutdown. The Senate has to approve the bill, too, and that could come as soon as tonight. After the House vote, McCarthy acknowledged that hardline Republicans could try to remove him from the speakership because he reached out to Democrats for help.
When are you guys going to get over that it's all right that you put America first? That it's all right if Republicans and Democrats join together to do what is right? If somebody wants to make a motion against me, bring it. There has to be an adult in the room.
It has been a hectic and chaotic day on Capitol Hill, and as always, congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins has been following all of it for us. Lisa, just 24 hours ago, it looked like a shutdown was inevitable. Right. And now here we are, one step away, a Senate vote away from putting it off. Right. What happened?
Yeah, I said it would take a legislative miracle, and in a way, we got one. It also needed a complete collapse of the House Republican Party, them realizing that they really did not have a plan at all, and that the only way out was either to go deeper in and cause a lengthy shutdown, or to have a simple continuing resolution to fund government that they thought would pass with many Democrats.
You just heard the speaker say, bring it on, about a motion, what's called a motion to vacate the speakership. Do you think, is that going to happen?
I think it will. I don't know when. He is calling what he thinks is the bluff of those hardliners who oppose him. But it doesn't matter to them if they win or not. They have a point to make. They really do object to the speaker. They have the ability, just single member, to try and motion to vacate him. And if they do that, even if the vast majority of Republicans support Speaker McCarthy, the question's up to Democrats, because you need a majority of the House to elect a speaker. So Democrats can then sort of maneuver, maybe try and get something out of Speaker McCarthy to help him keep his job. It leads to a lot of other different plot lines.
Now, what's the outlook in the Senate right now?
It looks good. Senators want to pass this deal. It's a question of when, how fast they can move. Senate not known for its exceeding speed. But tonight, they want to avoid this deadline. They don't want to shut down, even a Sunday one. As we speak right now, they are asking every senator if they will object to speeding this up. And if, in fact, all senators give the green light, we could have a vote within minutes or hours.
So if the Senate goes along, it's a 45-day reprieve. What has to happen, or what do they want to happen in that 45 days?
So this is part of what this entire debate has been about, spending in general. In the House, they would like to pass all 12 appropriations bills. So far, they've passed five of them. So they still have a lot of work ahead of them. It takes a long time to get 400 members to debate all these appropriations bills, especially some of the more controversial ones that are ahead. They want to use that time to do that. And also, by the way, negotiate those bills with the Senate. We're not just talking dollars and the size of government, which in of itself is a very difficult debate, but also policy. These bills contain things about abortion. Should abortion pills be allowed to be sold in the mail, for example? Those are intractable, long-time debates that may take more than 45 days as well, but now they've got another 45 days to try and figure it out.
What does this past 24 hours tell us about the House Republicans, about the state of the House Republican Party?
I think that it is what we expected. I think that we knew that this was a body that operates on instinct and not on plan. There is not really strategy. They have no problems with sort of internal debates that could even put the entire nation and government funding at risk. But it also tells us a lot about Kevin McCarthy. He is a speaker who lives day by day. He is confident in his ability to make it through even the toughest tests, but he doesn't have a plan for the next one. He takes them on one at a time, which means, John, you and I will be sitting here again talking about similar dynamics ahead, maybe even this week with the speaker.
Let's remind people what the alternative was. If the Senate hadn't done this,
right,
what the alternative would have been, and also what we'll be facing in 45 days.
Right. Well, the alternative, if they hadn't done this, we would have had a government shutdown starting tonight. That's 2 million federal workers, another 4 million federal contractors, many of whom would have been sent home. It could have gone long. And that would have meant maybe no paychecks for many of those people. Some services would have stopped, like WIC, the Program for Women, Infants, and Children. And also Moody's Analytics and others could have downrated our credit. So a lot was at stake. And now we have to kind of see the next steps, because all of that is still hanging in the balance again, and this time getting closer to Thanksgiving.
Never a dull moment. Lisa Desjardins,
no.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
In other news, New Yorkers began drying out today after one of the wettest days in decades. Record rainfall, more than 8 inches in some parts of the city, overwhelmed the city's drainage system, knocking out subway and commuter rail lines, turning roadways into rivers, and stranding people in cars and flooded apartments. No deaths or critical injuries have been reported, but the city remains under a state of emergency. And the White House is sounding the alarm about a buildup of Serbian troops along the border with Kosovo, and NATO has beefed up its forces in northern Kosovo. Long-standing tensions escalated last weekend when armed Serbs stormed a northern Kosovo village and killed a local police officer. U.S. officials are urging the two sides to continue talks mediated by the European Union. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, why some cities' neighborhoods are hotter than others, and a look at prostate cancer, one of the most common cancers among American men.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
This summer, cities across the United States broke thousands of heat records. But in many of them, some areas were hotter than others, what are known as urban heat islands. And that can mean higher energy bills for some and unsafe conditions. Blair Waltman-Alexson of Austin PBS, in conjunction with Austin Vita, has this report.
Berta Hernandez lives in the Dove Springs neighborhood of Austin, and selling her homemade tamales and pupusas is her main source of income. But she's making less money this year.
Well, I had to change because of the heat, because I no longer go out to sell the same as I did before. The sun won't let me. It's too hot. So even if I want to go out, I can't.
Over the summer, Austin saw record-breaking heat. But some areas of the city see hotter temperatures than others, and that can mean higher energy bills for residents. Mark Kuder is with the City of Austin's Office of Resilience.
We have data that shows heat from satellites. It mostly shows areas like parking lots, the airport, and so on. And that's valuable information, but doesn't really tell you what's happening on the ground level.
So the City of Austin teamed up with researchers at the University of Texas to see exactly what was going on. What they found was higher temperatures in places with less greenery. This is called the urban heat island effect. Dr. Dev Nayogi is a professor of geosciences and engineering at the University of Texas at Austin.
And the solar radiation that comes in over these urban areas, it gets absorbed into the streets, into the steel, into all the infrastructure that is required. And so when you measure the temperatures, you will get that there are blobs which are much hotter. It will look like an island, and that's why it gets referred to as an urban heat island. Those temperatures could be different by anywhere between 5 to 10 degrees.
This is what Hernandez and others are dealing with. Areas with impervious cover absorb and reflect the sun's rays, increasing temperatures. But not everyone is feeling the heat.
Some parts of the city, it is much cooler, and other parts of the city are much, much warmer.
Some of this can be traced back to redlining practices that started in the 1930s, when the federal government labeled non-white neighborhoods as risky places to invest home loans. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, research shows that redlined communities have less vegetative cover, higher temperatures, and increased health risks.
If you look at maps that look at health outcomes or a map that look at race or income, they essentially show the same maps. And we, through talking to community members, understand that they are the most sensitive to heat, but also cold, bad air quality, and so on.
These neighborhoods also often have older homes that can be harder to keep cool, according to Dr. Zoltan Nagy. He studies architecture and climate change at the University of Texas.
So older homes are particularly vulnerable to this. You have, you know, your single-pane windows, the holes around the windows, the what air comes in directly, not just through heat transfer, but mass transfer. So the hot air comes in or the cold air goes out. Plus, of course, over time you deteriorate, right? So anything built before the 80s is probably not even insulated at this point.
Many homes in Hernandez's neighborhood were built in the 70s, and older homes plus higher temperatures equals higher energy bills.
It's not well insulated. It's also old and not well insulated.
There is another thing that happens, which is that those who cannot afford it delay energy use, and so they turn their HVAC on a lot later, it's a lot warmer inside, and so that creates all kinds of adverse, like health effects. And then because due to climate change, it gets worse outside, right? Maybe you delay turning on the AC, but then the conditions last longer and longer, so it's really not good.
So they have to make a decision between not using energy and staying cool, and that's a very hard conversation to have.
It's a conversation Hernandez has had more than once.
Well, it's also difficult if we want to save electricity because it's getting very expensive. So there are moments when we have to put up with the heat because we can't have the air on all day.
Heat has pushed electricity bills higher for everyone. But for lower-income households, that increase is harder to deal with.
The cost associated, it might seem like it is $50 more, but that $50 would be quite different as against certain neighborhoods where this might be a significant dent in the monthly budget.
Cities can take steps to turn down the heat. Kuder and his team are making recommendations to the city council that include adding trees and improving bus stops. But they agree action needs to be taken, and quickly.
We need to be thinking about what we need today, but also what are strategies we need to be doing in the next year, 2 years, as climate change gets worse.
For now, Hernandez says she'll continue to get out early and get back inside before the temperature rises.
Well, you can't be defeated. You have to push forward so the heat doesn't impoverish us any more than we are.
For PBS News Weekend, I'm Blair Waltman-Alexin in Austin.
This year alone, nearly 300,000 American men are expected to be diagnosed with prostate cancer, though most of those diagnosed with it don't die from it. On this final day of Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, Allie Rogan takes a look at screening, diagnosis, and treatment of the disease and what it means to live with it.
Prostate cancer is the most common cancer among men in the U.S. and the second most common cause of cancer-related deaths. And glaring racial disparities exist within the disease. 1 in 8 men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer during their lifetime, but that rate increases to 1 in 6 for African American men. But a diagnosis doesn't have to be life-changing. In fact, many men with certain types of slow-growing prostate cancer are able to forego surgery and treatment altogether. Dr. Charles Ryan is a genitourinary oncologist, and he heads the Prostate Cancer Foundation. Dr. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us. Let's start with the absolute basics. What is prostate cancer, and where does it originate in the body?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me and to explain this important issue. The prostate is a gland that is very important in male reproduction. It essentially produces the fluid that allows the sperm to fertilize an egg. So without it, we are not able to reproduce. It exists at the base of the bladder. And it is really part of the male urinary tract, but also the male genital tract, allowing sperm to be released from the body.
And I know the options for prostate cancer screening and whether or not someone is a good candidate for it is a complicated issue. There are lots of factors that go into that. But let's start with what sort of screening is available for prostate cancer.
Right. So the prostate cancer screening has long involved a test, a blood test called a PSA test, and for many years involved a digital rectal exam, which is also called the finger test. So a doctor inserting his finger into the rectum of the patient to see if there's a tumor that one can feel. We also now incorporate MRI scanning, and over time the MRI scan is really replacing the digital rectal exam because it's less uncomfortable and it's actually more accurate.
The U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, which is an independent body that makes recommendations on disease prevention, recommends currently that men aged 55 to 69 not get automatically screened, but rather discuss the pros and cons of screening with their provider. The USPTF doesn't recommend screening at all for men over the age of 70. But my question is, if prostate cancer is, as we said, so widespread, why shouldn't all men get tested?
Well, it's important to remember that with regards to screening, that there are three distinct groups of individuals who can get prostate cancer. The first is a group that have such low risk disease that they may not require any treatment. And our current estimates are that that may constitute 20 to 25% of all of the men diagnosed with prostate cancer in the United States. There's a second group, which is patients who are curable with treatment options as long as the disease is confined to the prostate. So those are the ones who really benefit the most from screening and early detection. There's a third group for whom the treatment options are not optimal, and they are not guaranteed a cure with current treatment options. And for those, we need to do more research and develop better treatment options. It's important to remember also that screening does not necessarily automatically lead to a certain type of treatment. And that's been some of the misunderstanding that's created the problems that we're seeing now with a rising incidence of prostate cancer in its advanced stages.
And what are the current treatment options for people that are in those cohorts for whom treatment would work?
So for the low-risk group, we have a program called active surveillance, which is monitoring. And it's not that they never receive treatment. Some of them, and many of them actually do, but it's delayed until later. Those involve repeat biopsies, MRI scans, and close surveillance from a treating physician. But for men who are in the curable group, the main treatments remain surgical removal of the prostate, radiation therapy to the prostate, which has really evolved a lot over recent years, and then combinations with other approaches, such as hormonal approaches that may help radiation do a better job. In advanced disease, we've seen a tremendous growth of a number of therapies with a whole variety of different mechanisms of action that extend life and improve its quality for men, even with advanced stage metastatic prostate cancer.
We mentioned in the introduction this persistent racial disparity in terms of diagnoses and outcomes. Why does it seem that Black men continue to be disproportionately affected by prostate cancer?
The cause of that disparity are complex and probably include a combination of both biological factors, genetic factors, as well as societal factors. One key observation is that prostate cancer occurring in a Black man is likely to occur earlier in life, and such that a screening when performed earlier may detect a curable cancer earlier than it would be for example, a non-Black man. So starting screening at the age of 50 may not be adequate, for example, for a population where the disease is likely to begin even as early as age 40.
I want to return to the issue of active surveillance that you mentioned. Some studies have shown that some people on active surveillance, when they're not receiving treatment, they eventually do have to undergo some sort of treatment. Does that indicate that testing needs to advance in terms of being able to determine the potential seriousness of slow-growing prostate cancer?
Well, it's a wonderful question because we, in fact, are learning a lot more about the biological heterogeneity of this disease. And so when we're making a decision about whether a patient would be an ideal candidate for active surveillance, we incorporate genetic studies now and genetic factors that look at the interplay of a number of genes. And that can help us further stratify a potential patient for immediate treatment or deferred treatment.
The treatments and the surgeries that currently exist for men dealing with prostate cancer tend to be very serious and potentially life-altering. What are the prospects that you see for the future of that discipline? Is it getting better? Is it allowing men to continue to have happy and healthy lives?
Because of the location of the prostate at the base of the bladder and as a key component to the male sexual function, the worries around treatment side effects do include urinary function and sexual function. Over the course of the past couple of decades, the surgical field has made tremendous strides in preserving sexual function and improving and preserving good urinary function. So one of the problems we have when we're thinking about the treatment-related side effects is, where are we getting our data from? If we're talking to patients who had their treatment 15, 20 years ago, it was a very different setting back then than what we see now. Of course, there are cases where the cancer is more advanced and it's more difficult to preserve those functions. But today, many men are quite optimistic about their treatment, and there are many men out there living happy, normal lives after undergoing curative treatment for prostate cancer.
Dr. Charles Ryan, head of the Prostate Cancer Foundation, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Mahogany Brown is a poet, writer, organizer, and educator. Recently, she became the first ever poet in residence at New York City's Lincoln Center, where she's trying to expose more people to poetry. Tonight, she shares her brief but spectacular take on poetry as ritual.
The importance of ritual as a poem, as a practice, is finding stillness and reminding yourself to breathe. How do you quiet the mind? Even though you may not be able to understand quiet in the middle of New York City streets, but it is possible to quiet your mind, to get to a place where you can be at peace and have promise. I'm going to ask you all to participate with me in this piece. This is going to be a communal meditation. The poem ritual is about meditation, it's about breathing, and it's about seizing the day rather than worrying about tomorrow. Today you will. Today you choose. Today is yours. Today is only today. Tomorrow ain't here yet, so slow down. I was interested in creating ritual because I live in Brooklyn, New York, and I rarely found a space quiet enough to meditate. And so this poem became a part of my meditation practice, and now it's something that I do every day. Breathe. For the homies that ain't here, breathe. For the kin that is, breathe. For your own good skin, your smile, your you. As someone who's aware of her anxiety, the ritual became very crucial for me to just find a place to have deep breaths, and I think that it will offer that to the listeners as well.
Now come back. Come back. Come back to yourself.
I do say poetry is a transformative tool because I believe it allows us to use poetry as a mirror, and we can look very deeply and intently. We can study it without judgment, and we can allow ourselves to grow from the things that we see versus the things that we thought we were seeing. Poetry allows us a step back, some distancing, and a lot of compassion.
Miraculous stargaze. Most fortunate skybeam. Beyond brilliant be your resilience, but you knew that already. Who told you any different? You tell them, today you will. And today you choose, because tomorrow ain't here yet, so slow down, breathe.
My name is Mahogany L. Brown, and this is my brief but spectacular take on poetry as ritual.
And you can watch more brief but spectacular videos online at pbs.org/newshour/brief. And that is PBS News Weekend for this Saturday. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow.